Welcome to OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Chris Ryan. OncLive On Air is a podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Paul G. Richardson, MD, about the investigation of mezigdomide and dexamethasone in the treatment of patients with heavily pretreated relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. Dr. Richardson is a physician, clinical program leader, and director of clinical research at the Jerome Lipper Multiple Myeloma Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, as well as the R.J. Corman Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, both in Boston, Massachusetts. Data from a phase 1-2 trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine demonstrated that the combination of mezigdomide and dexamethasone elicited an overall response rate of 25% among 77 patients with relapsed refractory multiple myeloma treated in the study's phase 1 dose escalation cohort. Additionally, 101 patients treated in the phase 2 dose expansion cohort achieved an overall response rate of 41%. Safety findings showed that the most common toxicities were primarily myelotoxic adverse effects. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Richardson walked through the background of mezigdomide, the design of the phase 1-2 study, key efficacy and safety findings with the regimen, and the implications of what this combination could mean for heavily pretreated patients with relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. Thank you, Dr. Richardson, for meeting with us at OncLive to discuss the investigation of mezigdomide in patients with relapsed refractory multiple myeloma.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to join you. And again, mezigdomide, we give it a nice name. We call it Mezi for short, a deliberate pun on the wonderful Argentinian soccer player, Mr. Mezi. But anyway, mezigdomide is, we nickname it Mezi for short, just to make it a little bit easier. But it's in fact CC92480. And as I share with you today, some of the top line data in terms of the activity that we have seen with this incredibly potent oral agent and the results that were published in the New England Journal. I thought it might be great for our listeners just to think about a little bit of backdrop here. I think it's worth sharing with the group that essentially, as we think about multiple myeloma, it is just that. It is multiple subgroups of disease under one umbrella. So it's truly not one disease. And in that same spirit, the construct of one size not fitting all is very clear cut now, more than ever. Fortunately, we've got a plethora of novel agents to meet that challenge, and they range, obviously, from immunomodulatory drugs, proteasome inhibitors, monoclonal antibodies, other small molecules, to now the revolution of immuno-oncology, and in particular, what we've seen in terms of the advent of CAR T therapy with adoptive cellular treatment, and at the same time, of course, T-cell redirection utilizing bispecifics. But I think it's very important to recognize the value, of course, of targeting immune suppression in myeloma and doing so with truly off-the-shelf strategies, which are essentially able to overcome some of the logistic challenges that are very real with what I've just described. So I think as we think about this, it's important to note that in that construct, we have this heterogeneity of disease, multiple patient-related, myeloma-related factors that can impact on treatment outcomes. Immune dysfunction is pretty fundamental. And there's this, of course, this high mutational burden. And so, of course, as I mentioned, the newly diagnosed patients, of course, are highly diverse. But even more importantly, as the disease becomes relapsed refractory, it becomes even more challenging. So I think this is really important to consider. And I really show this construct to sort of emphasize the importance of translating what we see in clinical science to real-world practice. So with that all in mind and the natural history of myeloma being what it is, and now that we're seeing many patients in our practices live 10, 15 years with their disease, but recognizing it's important to realize that these are medians, and under that umbrella of progress, the high-risk group of patients, which constitutes about a third of those patients we see, still have very challenging disease in terms of longevity of disease control and overall survival. And overall survival in higher-risk group patients can be much shorter. Conversely, standard risk patients in whom the disease and the pathobiology of it may be less aggressive and less challenging can live many, many years. In any event, with that as a backdrop, I think we think of oral therapies in the context of what I just alluded to, which is that obviously we have a very substantial number of our patients who are older. Obviously, in communities where access to tertiary and quaternary centers may be more limited. And above all, our disease is also predominant in patients of African American heritage. And this is very, very important. So this ability to offer treatments that have real access to communities as diverse as our myeloma populations are, is absolutely vital in my opinion. The translation of this to real world practice is self-evident. And in that context, we're particularly excited about the results of 480. Mezigdomide, I'll call it Mezi for short now. But what's so exciting about Mezi is that it is really a potent degrader. It's able to maximally degrade Aiolos, and in that context, also Ikaros. It engages as a larger molecule than the IMiDs, which are in the same broad category of cereblon E3 ligase engagers. But this truly, Mezigdomide, I think of more as a true cereblon modulator, and hence the term CELMoD. And in that spirit, downstream of this engagement into this key pocket in the cereblon E3 ligase complex is this ability to, in a targeted fashion, optimally degrade Aiolos and do so far more powerfully than, for example, we see in preclinical models than pomalidomide or lenalidomide. And this, in turn, results in remarkable apoptosis inside the myeloma cell itself. How then does this translate in terms of proliferation? The antiproliferative activity in lenalidomide and pomalidomide resistant cell lines in model systems is quite striking, and may be also seen in the context of both parental and resistant cell lines when you look at the impact of mezigdomide. What's interesting, though, is this idea that there must be some level of cereblon present in order for these molecules to work preclinically, that is, at least. So with that in mind, how did this all translate into the clinical setting? This was a phase 1-2 study in which we evaluated mezigdomide both alone and in combination with dexamethasone, which preclinically it's highly synergistic with, in relapsed refractory myeloma. And in the first part of the study, we established a recommended phase 2 dose of mezigdomide in combination with dex, and this turned out to be 1 milligram, 3 weeks on and 1 week off dose daily. And then we moved into a second phase, which was this dose expansion phase, to establish what we'd seen in the context of the original part one of the trial. It's important to note that in the phase 1 part of the trial, in this dose escalation phase, we'd been able to document to the recommended phase 2 dose a response rate of approximately 55%. Now, not in a large number of patients, obviously, and given the inherent nature of phase 1 design, but nonetheless compelling. And of course, the tolerability profile was exciting because what we were able to demonstrate quite nicely was that the primary toxicities were hematologic. Non-heme toxicity was much less common, much less challenging than we sometimes see with other approaches. And interesting enough, our infection rates were relatively low despite the myelosuppression that is a critical aspect of these drugs, but a manageable one. And above all, we didn't see the sign of signals of COVID mortality that were being seen at that time in other clinical trials, which suggested a different degree of potentially immune suppression and compromise. Well, this was further validated when we moved into the part two cohort, which we first presented at ASH in December of last year. And as I mentioned now, is published in full in the New England Journal. And what we show here is that when you combine mezigdomide with traditional dosing of dexamethasone once a week, all, of course, these patients were steroid refractory. That's an important point. But we dosed at 40 milligrams once a week for patients under the age of 75. And for those patients age 75 or older, by protocol, dosing of dexamethasone was less at 20 milligrams. This is a standard approach to minimize toxicities associated with steroid use. And patients had to have had at least 3 prior lines of treatment to qualify for the study: refractoriness to immunomodulatory treatments, proteasome inhibition, and anti-CD38 antibody therapy was mandatory. And most importantly, they had to be truly refractory. In other words, not only relapsing on treatment or at least within 60 days. So this was a strict requirement for entry into this part two of the study. Finally, and I think this is really important for the audience, we allowed patients in whom anti-BCMA therapies had been used and had failed. So I think this was an important point, that patients who were BCMA exposed and or refractory were eligible for the trial. Now, in the context of the endpoints, the primary endpoint in the second part of the study was overall response rate, with traditional secondary endpoints, including duration of response. And then exploratorily, we looked at pharmacodynamics, which I'm going to come to in a minute. So these are actually the characteristics of the patients. There were 101 patients in the second part of the study to share. The median number of prior lines of therapy was 6. And in that context, the vast majority had had stem cell transplant, over 3/4. All of them had been exposed to pomalidomide, lenalidomide, proteasome inhibition, and monoclonal antibodies, as you expect. And about a third had received anti-BCMA therapy, including predominantly antibody drug conjugates, but also bispecific T-cell engagers and CAR-T therapy. They were classically, you know, refractory as defined. So this was an important analysis of the patient characteristics going to the trial. I think no one would argue that this would not constitute a population of exquisite unmet medical need. Also in this group of patients, a large number of patients had extramedullary disease. So we looked at this comprehensively, and this is really the takeaway from the study. Essentially, the response rates confirmed by an independent committee for the study overall were 41%, including complete responses and very good partial responses and stringent complete responses. And at the same time, in specific subgroups, the EMD population, extramedullary disease population, which we define as patients with plasmacytomas, and of course, systemic relapse refractory disease, a very poor prognostic group, we saw a response rate of 30% in this group. And what was fascinating to us, we have to be careful because the number of patients is actually about 30. So again, we mustn't hang our hat completely on this. But I do think we were very impressed at the overall response rate in the BCMA-exposed patients, as well as being triple-class refractory and also having other poor prognostic features, such as high-risk cytogenetics and EMD. The response rate was 50%. So this really caught our attention. And I think what you can see is that the time to first response was rapid. What was interesting also was that our duration of response in the responding patients was encouraging. And if, for example, you had a very good partial response, DOR was a median of about 9 months, which I think is encouraging. The median PFS for the group as a whole, classic for this very sick population, was a little more modest at around 4.5 months. But that's very typical for monotherapies in this setting, especially ones that are oral and truly outpatient, as of course mezigdomide is. But nonetheless, to see this drug performing in the way that it did in this highly refractory resistant population, I think is very compelling, and particularly as, you know, it's an oral approach. Now, also very importantly, our oldest patient in the study was over 85. So I think that's an important point to share because clearly whilst we're very excited by the promise of CAR-T and bispecifics, we have to recognize they require hospitalization and also they are necessarily, because of their nature, potentially challenging for the octogenarian patients that we have in our practice and, for that matter, you know, other frailer patients as well. What was also very interesting was the pharmacodynamics in the study. We looked at this very comprehensively, and I especially want to acknowledge my co-investigators because this was absolutely vital, and especially also acknowledge our pharma partner, BMS Celgene, because they had a really comprehensive effort to try and nail down the pharmacodynamics. In addition to the pharmacokinetics as part of the original dose escalation phase in what we were doing. A patient of mine who had previously come into the study, unfortunately having had a great response initially, but then become refractory to the combination of isatuximab, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone. In the screening bone marrow, the immunohistochemistry was enriched for ALOS. So clearly this pathway was breaking through. Just after a week of therapy with mezigdomide and dexamethasone, we saw this. I'm very grateful to our patient for allowing us to do that 1 week aspirate follow-up because this is the kind of data that, you know, speaks a thousand words. If you looked across the study as a whole, we saw impressive changes in tumor ALOS associated with their treatment, and that above all, that we saw peripheral blood immunophenotyping even in patients who were POM refractory, modulating in a favorable way. So this really supported the notion that mezigdomide can work when pomalidomide has failed. And I think that really sets this apart in a clinical sense from obviously the immunomodulated class broadly. And then as we move into this category of the cerebrons, the cell mods, including iberdomide, which is less potent than mezigdomide, an important point to make, but still very active, we can see real distinctions. And when you've got pharmacodynamic data like this, I think it's very promising. So let's give you some real examples. I mean, I think for our audience, you know, as clinicians, it's lovely to share this. From the original dose escalation phase, part one, this is, again, an example of the activity of this drug in extramedullary disease. This is actually from my co-senior investigator, Nizar Balis, who was the senior author of the paper, recognizing our both of us having leadership role in the study. And the important point with this patient from Nizar's practice is this: prior to initiation of mezigdomide, this patient not only had aggressive triple class refractory disease, but also had substantial extramedullary involvement as illustrated in the liver. After treatment had been onboarded for some time, a few months in fact, you can see almost complete resolution here. And this patient had an outstanding response to treatment. If you looked at the 1 milligram dose group in this particular swimmer's plot, you can see that at 1 milligram, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, we were seeing some very consistent and exciting results in the extramedullary disease group. So this, I think, is really compelling. And then I want to go next to a patient of mine who was part of the part two expansion group. Lower PET CT illustrates the tumor burden that this poor gentleman had at start. He was in real trouble. He'd had multiple prior therapies, including BCMA targeting treatment. He had extramedullary disease everywhere, but most importantly, as a clinical vignette, he had EMD growing across his portocath. So we couldn't actually access his port when we started therapy because there was disease across it. Remarkably, with therapy after 4 months, he had complete resolution on PET CT. My nursing team were telling me how remarkable it was, is that they could actually safely now access his portocath. Needless to say, he was delighted. So this is an example of really the power of this platform, you know, that you can see showing the efficacy of the drug. I would also argue this particular patient tolerated this drug remarkably well, but obviously myelosuppression matters, infections matter, and we have to be on top of all of those things. But broadly speaking, we found the combination strategy with dexamethasone, on the one hand, manageable from the point of view of any tolerability issues, and toxicities encountered were truly reversible with growth factor support, dose adjustment, and so forth. Now, you may say, what are the future directions? I think, obviously, combination strategies. Preclinically, we have synergy with proteasome inhibitors and antibodies, and this has gone forward very nicely. In the New England Journal editorial, there was a comment, well, you know, would we run into trouble with, you know, irreversible myelosuppression or anything of that nature? And we've absolutely not seen that. The dose going forward in combination has typically been about 0.6 milligrams daily, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, in some of the combination strategies that we've done. So you bring down the actual dose a little bit and then combine it with other drugs. And can share with you that in combination with bortezomib, we've already presented this data. We have response rates in relapsed refractory disease approaching 80%, which is quite remarkable. And with daratumumab, the same. And interestingly enough, with carfilzomib too. So, you know, we're seeing this potent platform for combination strategies in earlier disease going forward. And those phase three studies now interrogating this are indeed now underway. And we're very pleased to be part of those, together with colleagues from all across North America and Europe. So this is encouraging, but obviously these are, you know, specialist centers, but we're very much hoping we'll have, you know, increased access to what we believe is an important platform. I would say to you, the BCMA piece is another exciting new frontier. And as was mentioned in the editorial by Dr. Schott, the issue of combining this with the new BCMA platforms and the cellular therapies in particular makes great sense. I think obviously, we'll have to see. Trials are planned with combining this powerful platform with T-cell redirecting therapy, and importantly also as a post-CAR-T strategy. I think one of the most interesting things is we saw in combination activity with mezigdomide and elotuzumab, recognizing there's this interaction with natural killer cells. Now, obviously, if CAR-T therapy fails a patient, natural killers are an access point that one could illegitimately exploit. And in that spirit, my colleagues, Dr. Omar Nadim, is leading a trial combining iberdomide with elotuzumab, but may in fact also now be incorporating mezigdomide based on these data into that platform to see how we can rationally exploit the science demonstrating is happening in patients, not just in the lab, and then bring safe combinations. Because, you know, as clinicians know, after CAR-T therapy, patients are perhaps arguably a little bit more vulnerable. They may have other issues that you have to be aware of, in particular cytopenias and infections. And so there are a number of considerations there. But I think your point's very well taken that we need strategies to salvage patients after BCMA-targeted approaches have failed. I think one of the most exciting things, of course, is that we have GPRC5D now as a target. We also now have FCRH5. So there are an abundance of other targets. That doesn't in any way change, in my opinion, the potential for mezigdomide to have a very crucial role if any of those approaches fails a patient. because then you can come in with, again, the convenience of oral treatment. One thing I was going to share with you, Chris, which is an observation from one of my patients, actually. She had had, you know, inpatient stays for a variety of immune therapy strategies and had found these pretty exhausting, actually. And she just said, I don't mind what we do now, because unfortunately her bispecific ran out of steam for her. She said, I don't mind what we do now, but I really would like to do something outpatient where I do not have to come into the hospital. And I think that's something we shouldn't underestimate the power of. And I think this is particularly important for patients in communities, in the rural setting, in suburban settings, where it may not be easy to access tertiary / quaternary centers where your IO exists or is best leveraged. And so I think these are really important points to consider. Again, we're not at a response rate of 70%, agreed, but we are a response rate of 41 or 50%, depending on where you're landing. And that ain't bad for an oral platform. So I think there's a bright future for mezigdomide, in my opinion. And I think that, like all things, you know, we'll have to wait and see what the phase threes show. But I think right now we've got a very big phase two experience here that provides a body of evidence to support trying to move this drug forward as quickly as possible for our patients in most exquisite unmet medical need. I think the important message for providers and caregivers in myeloma broadly is that we all know we're now up to 18 potential therapeutic options in myeloma, and a huge thank you to the regulatory authorities for making all of this possible, because it's incredible, as well, of course, as the enormous efforts in investigation and, above all, the participation of our patients and families. The thing that I'm worried about is people say, well, you've got enough. You know, surely you can figure this all out. You've got enough. You've cured this cancer, haven't you? Absolutely not. Multiple myeloma is just that, and it's always not a matter of one versus the other. It is always all hands to the pumps, if you excuse the metaphor. It really is. I mean, there is no, we're not curing people in any substantial scale. We're achieving disease control that lasts for much longer than it ever did in an increasing proportion of patients. But personally, you know, my clinic, you know, we specialize in relapse refractory disease. And, you know, I think we need to be very thoughtful. We have patient subgroups. We have elderly, frail. We have patients in whom there is immune exhaustion. All of these caveats that really need to be borne in mind as we think of therapeutic options. And, you know, we're blessed that we see patients now living 10, 15, even 20 and 30 years. But we must be aware that there are substantial numbers who don't even get nearly close to that. And at the same time, there are patients in whom certain treatment modalities, exciting and wonderful as they have been, really are just simply not feasible and or not safe. And so with that in mind, I'm particularly excited about how we think about the CELMoDs and mezigdomide in particular, as well as other oral agents, and for that matter, other strategies targeting different targets, different modalities, that are truly outpatient, you know, that don't require you to be in the hospital. They can be infusional in the clinic. They can be things that don't require multiple visits, et cetera. We need to be very much aware of the value of these as we go forward.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. And if you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.